Dick Spotswood has had many years of experience in record production, record reissues, and most recently has been working on an NEA-funded project to compile the first comprehensive discography of ethnic music recorded in the United States. Dick?
I should add to the announcements and things that Tim was giving. I was up briefly in the control room yesterday, and if anyone wants copies of recordings of this conference, it's a good idea to get any comments or questions or whatever into those microphones. Otherwise, we're able to hear it easily in this room, but posterity is going to have a bad time. So address, you know, throughout the proceedings, just put any questions into those microphones. They're there as much for the tape recorder as for anything else. Unless, of course, you don't want to go on record. Okay. To summarize this ethnic discography project and to give you a little idea of how it all came about, I'm going to close this top for a minute. Eye contact is important. I don't want to lose it with anybody over there, so if anyone was hiding behind it, I'm sorry. Several years ago, I left a perfectly good and honest job to go to the Library of Congress at the request of the Archive of Folk Song there to begin work on a rather fat 15 LP record anthology that was being prepared nominally in honor of the bicentennial called Folk Music in America. I thought it was a great idea. There really needed to be a good sort of blanket anthology of what American folk music was, at least at its sources, and of all the many various regional and folk-derived styles. And it occurred to me right from the beginning that there needed to be some kind of foreign-speaking components. I was vaguely aware at the time that, yes, there had been some foreign records made because as a sometime collector over the years, I've gone through the Salvation Armies and thrift stores, etc., and seen these funny old green label Columbias and orange OKs, etc., not knowing much what to make of them and assuming they would be of no interest to anyone, just put them back and kept on looking for Jelly Roll Morton and Furry Lewis. I'd like to have some of the gold that undoubtedly slipped through my fingers, because as I got to digging further and further trying to get at material for the Library of Congress record series, I was finding that not only were there a great many of these various foreign series that major labels had produced, but that some of the music on them was outrageously good. And as I went to dig a little further, I began to find that these were the products of the people who came over during the Great Migration from 1880 up till the passage of the Emergency Quota Act in 1921, when the gates to European and other immigration were virtually sealed off, at least until the mid-60s. And this music was the outpouring of these people, the majority of whom were from the village or rural societies, who in many cases came from cultures where phonographs were either unheard of or unnecessary or most often unaffordable. By the time they got to the United States, they found that Victor and Columbia both were selling cheap wind-up models by 1920 or thereabouts that were $10 to $15. And that the records themselves that they were producing were by their own foreign-speaking artists, in many cases recorded in this country. But I'm jumping ahead of my story just a little bit. In any case, there was a huge demand, and record producers knew it almost from the infancy of the industry. And by the time 1910 had rolled around, there was a great deal of production in many areas, both domestic production and of course a lot from South America, Latin America, where American countries controlled the production, manufacturing, and distribution, all the way from New York, Camden, and Bridgeport, on down to Bogota and other South American locations. So it was big business for them. Pekka Gronoff has said a couple of times in print that the production of these records for a couple of decades equaled or outstripped the production of domestic popular records. It's an amazing statement, but it seems to be true. The Victor Foreign series, which began, I assume, around the time they first began issuing double-faced records in 1908 and began with their 16,000 popular series, ran through about 10,000 records, black label 10-inch and 12-inch, at the time that the 16,000 series had gotten up not quite to 20,000. In other words, just a superficial examination seems to suggest that the foreign output was not quite double of the domestic popular black label recordings. So it appeared to me as the years went on that this was a project that was worth examining. I don't mean project, I mean just a field of recording. And to make some sort of a project out of it, I began to think very seriously about turning from a consumer of discography, which is all I had ever been in my life, to trying to compile one. And discovering that a grant was possible from the National Endowment for the Arts under somewhat unusual circumstances. They don't usually fund production of books or literature, but more often of performance kinds of things. This is for those of you not from the United States. It is essentially a government funding agency for projects they consider worthwhile in all fields of artistic endeavor. This project should normally have come out of the National Endowment for the Humanities, which funds, which has specific programs for building collections of materials for the production of reference works and so on. But they also, in those years, were drawing the line at anything that smacked of popular or folk culture, which was sort of why I was steered over to NEA. That's political in any case. They did manage to come up with the money to fund the study, and it's been going on now. My own personal involvement has been in it since the beginning of 1979. I need to break at some point, and I guess it's pretty arbitrary when, but in order to make the whole thing a little bit less esoteric, I need to play a little bit of music for you, and I've chosen a handful of recordings that are representative of various areas of the kind of music under examination and observation. Pretty things. Because I'm still sort of floating out in the field, collecting raw data, I don't have records in the form of anything else but records. I wasn't able to make a nice equalized tape and present it like Art Schifrin did in that marvelous presentation Tim gave yesterday afternoon. The phonograph is borrowed from the cataloging department upstairs, courtesy of the fine folks at the library here, and just hitched up on an informal basis here. What I want to do is just play three things in quick succession. The first one being a doina, or a Jewish air. That is, it's equivalent, I guess, to the kind of air that that a Scot would play on a bagpipe, a sort of slow but very elaborate improvised piece that's not meant for dancing, but for listening. It has its equivalents not only in the Western airs, but more in the Eastern Arabic and Turkish taksim. It's by Art Schreier's Modern Jewish Orchestra, that is to say, modern for 1924. It's a nice old red Vocalion in a 13,000 series, which was created especially for Jewish recordings. I don't know whether that was meant to send the Jews bad luck or what. They abandoned it somewhat. They abandoned it after 3 or 4 years and picked up another series entirely. So someone must certainly have objected to that number assignment. Schreier himself plays the cornet on the record, apparently taking taking a mute and putting it on his horn about 3/4 of the way through the performance, so that it sounds essentially like two different recordings. But it is essentially a doina, a concerto for him, for Schreier, his cornet, and his modern 1924 orchestra. I wanted to follow that with something I thought especially appealing to Canadians, a recording done the following year, 1925, one of the first Columbia Green Label electrical recordings by a Ukrainian fiddler named Paul Humaniuk, who, though a New York resident, was a man who had an enormous following in Canada, and not only in the Ukrainian community in Canada. His records sold marvelously well here, but he also appealed to other young fiddlers, Graham Townsend, for instance, of Ontario, has told me about the tunes he learned by going to a neighbor's house and listening to the Humaniuk records on a wind-up phonograph. And he's talking about the 40s, some years after Humaniuk made these records. The tune is a kolomeka, or a specific kind of Ukrainian dance. It follows a dumka at the beginning, which is a kind of Ukrainian variation of the doina, slow, stately, and somewhat improvised. Since the tune is called Vinko Pletny, it means an engagement ceremony in which a wreath is laid over the bride-to-be's head, and the little weeping and everything you hear in the background is the kind of weeping that traditionally went on at Eastern European engagement ceremonies and marriages. The third one I'd like to follow it with will bring it back in every sense culturally to this continent, a New York Cuban recording from 1934 by Pedro Marcano y su orquesta. Normally, Marcano appears on a fairly large number of recordings in the 30s simply as Grupo Marcano. The Grupo makes me think he may be actually a Puerto Rican, because Puerto Ricans tended to call their groups Grupos instead of Conjuntos or other things. But in any case, it's basically the Cuban style. The chorus of guitars underneath, overlaid with a little percussion. The thing that makes it an orquesta is that it's coming up to 1934, and you begin to hear the crossovers that the music is about to make in the work of people like Enrique Madriguera, Javier Cugat, Carlos Molina, and others, who are about to take the rumba music and the merengues and make them into Latin music from Manhattan. Marcano uses a little overlay of saxophones that's lifted right out of the Guy Lombardo Orchestra, sort of plunks them down in the middle of the recording, and then abandons them again. You don't hear them again, as if, well, they're there to make us an orquesta, to give us the modern sound for 1934, but he's saying essentially, we really don't know too much what to do with them. That's a summary of the three recordings. Let me play them for you quickly in sequence. Should have had it queued up. a few intimations of Harry James and Ziggy Elman, not quite yet to come.
This is the engagement ceremony.
This is Columbia, 1925. Sounds every bit of it. Thank you.
like to...
it's the microphone. I don't like to cut that off, but the thing is having tracking problems of some kind, and it's getting a little worse in toward the center. Just wanted to, you to hear the overlay of the Lombardo element on top. In any case, three recordings of very diverse, and in a couple of cases, I think, very brilliant styles, all of them from New York City within the span of a decade or so. Very remarkable output, and only the tip of the iceberg. They recorded in every language from Albanian to Welsh, and the scope of the discography is to try to get at all of these records that were made and to try and to document them insofar as possible as to date, place, the names of the participating musicians and every other bit of useful information that will yield itself up. In order to do this, I really had to kind of start cold. There was no collecting community behind me in the way even that there was when Charles Delaunay began his hot discography, published his hot discography in 1936 and formed the basis for a work that's been continued, revised, and added to over the years. So I simply went straight to every recording company file that I could locate. Fortunately, there was either complete or at least substantial information from five sources, from CBS, RCA, and in New York. The Institute for Jazz Studies in Rutgers were very helpful, let me copy the Jeanette ledgers and all of the other Jeanette-related material that they had. And even that label had a fair amount of ethnic output, surprisingly enough. The Edison National Historical Site in West Orange very obligingly opened up what they had for me. And MCA in Hollywood has microfilmed all of its files, which of course include the Brunswick's, Vocalions, the Deccas, going back to their files at least, go back to the year 1924, which leaves a few things unaccounted for. Along the way, in doing something like this in a very compact way, you really learn to have to be flexible, to operate with many different companies' filing systems and the strengths of the information some companies can give you, the weaknesses of the things that they can't provide. I suppose the biggest source of frustration was CBS, which my impression is that they were responsible for the lion's share of the activity in this field. Certainly they and RCA put together would have accounted for 90% or more of it. CBS has done us all a great favor. They assigned their ethnic recordings a special numbering series back in 1915 and kept those series going essentially until the demise of Columbia as such in the early 30s, until the time it was picked up as part of the American Record Corporation. During all those years from 1915 to 1935, I guess, separate series, matrix series, not just release numbers, were maintained for ethnic recordings of all kinds. Not only that, but the ethnics, that is to say, what, the Albanian, Lithuanian, Polish, Slovak, etc., was in one series. The Hispanic recordings had a series of its own, and actually within each of these there were other kinds of breakdowns. The 12-inch recordings had yet another series in each one of these blocks, and so it amounted to picking up on exactly what all of these series were. Tim Brooks, 5 years ago, published an article that was invaluable to me in Record Research, in which he attempted to take every identifiable block of Columbia master numbers during the acoustical period and to try and designate what it was. And that was a great help to me. In fact, I don't think I was able to go a good bit farther, terrifically farther than you did, Tim, all that time ago. The most wonderful thing Columbia did, though, was to keep all of these wonderful ethnic masters. I would say they are probably still in the Columbia vaults, 90 to 95% of them. When you consider all of the recordings, major and minor, that were contributed to the United States government during the scrap drives of World War II, this is a very marvelous thing. But this seems to be because all of the matrix files and other files describing what these matrices were tossed out sometime before then. And they couldn't identify their metal parts to throw them out. I'm sure if they could have, they would have been the first things to go, not the last. So in any case, when they took an inventory in 1964, they found thousands and thousands of these metal parts, which they were able to document by the matrix number, by the surviving take, etc. And nobody knows what they are. Not all of the other files survive, which would help to make a determination either. And this takes me into, because I'm running out of time here, the last part of this informal discourse, which is a sort of indication to you as to the areas that I need help in. And Columbia, in spite of my spending 9 months at their files and the great generosity of Tina McCarthy with both space and time during that period, I still need a great deal of information on Columbia. I am circulating, Bill Bryant has seen one and worked on it extensively, copies of the master numbers. It fills a notebook about like that from CBS of the ethnic masters during this period from 1915 roughly to 35, with a little blank beside each one where it is blank and an entry beside each one where the recording has been identified. Anybody that has access to or has any number of these Green Columbias, Spanish, ethnic, or whatever, and is about like that, from CBS, of the ethnic masters during this period from 1915 roughly to 35, with a little blank beside each one, where it is blank and an entry beside each one where the recording has been identified. Anybody that has access to or has any number of these Green Columbias, Spanish, ethnic, or whatever, and is willing to dive in, boy, I would be very, very glad to loan you a set of these master sheets and get you to help me fill them in. In fact, I'd be very grateful. The other areas that are going to be weak, pending significant input from sources I do not have now, are the smaller labels, like Emerson particularly, which had an extensive ethnic series, Vocalion before 1924, that is the Aeolian Vocalion period, the Pathé companies, especially from the vertical era, and of course all of the small independent ethnic companies that produced materials sometimes on their own, sometimes with the help of other little studios, but essentially for distribution and dissemination within their own immediate sphere. This is the kind of thing that the discography is so far lacking, and I need all the help I can get, frankly. It's tentatively to be published by the Library of Congress, who is tentatively offering me some sort of computer access in planning a program, which has yet to be done. Actually, I've examined the model that I understand someone addressed to you last year, the Rutgers Institute for Jazz Studies catalog. They've done extensive computerizing and created a very complex database for that, and I've just begun looking into that. And what I hope we'll see is a good discography, the product of a computer age, if not computer overkill, I hope, but capable of indexing and manipulating all of this material and refining it, so that all the inevitable imperfections in the first edition of this book will be easily and I hope inevitably correctable as work continues down the road in this area. The little bit of music I played for you this morning gives you some idea of my own fascination with it. I hope it was something you were able to share to a degree, but it's been added to my vocabulary of jazz, classical, country, gospel, etc., music that I enjoy hearing very much, and I hope to keep learning more about it as the years go by and to bring some of you into the ethnic camp with me. I don't know how much time I left him. Is there any time for questions? I meant to look to see what time I started, but 5 minutes for questions. Any, yes?
I'm David Hall from Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Okay. Yes.
You're acquainted with Pekka Gronow's work in the Scandinavian.
Yes.
Era, I take it.
I've assisted him in it in some way.
Anyway, we have at Rodgers and Hammerstein, still on catalog and to some extent still unsorted, but also there's substantial blocks arranged in alphanumeric order. Lots and lots of the Columbia E series and the X prefix series and so on. And, you know, if you can make available, do your master sheets have label designators too, or are they master sheets only?
They're master sheets in the sense that each piece of paper has...
Do they have the catalog?
1080 penciled in by me, and then 00102 and so on down to 99, typed in with a little, in columns of four with little spaces in between.
No catalog numbers.
Yeah, I'm adding catalog numbers as I identify the record and the names of the artists.
Well, you know, sometimes, as I say, I haven't seen these things in years and years and years since I was at Columbia Bridgeport in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember whether they had the actual catalog, manufacturer's catalog numbers appended to the containers of the metal parts or not. But anyway, if you can spare us some of the material, we'd be glad to look it over.
Great, you're on.
Do what we can as they. What's your deadline on this?
Like everything else, ASAP.
Well, anyway, you know, let us have a look.
There's a lot of variables yet.
Let us have a
I
look.
I hope
at
no
it.
One asked me when I expect the work to be published.
Let's have a look at it and send it up to New York.
You got it. I'll send you one as soon as I'm home.
Thanks.
Thank you. Nothing else after that generous offer of support? I'll turn it back over to Tim if there's no other questions.
You were talking mostly about the Columbia series, and I was wondering if you were having any...
It's the hardest. It's because it's the hardest. Go ahead, I'm sorry. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
If you were having any problems or need any help on the Victors and what was happening with that and any of the other series... They needed help.
Victor, bless their heart, by contrast with Columbia, maintained essentially only one matrix series from the very beginning, that is from the consolidated, no, just after the consolidated Eldridge-Johnson period, from 1901 until 1936. The one they started in 1936 lasted until 1943. They didn't branch off into a lot of funny areas, and the Masters series held true for Red Seal, Bluebird, Victor, Children's series, LPs. The only things they did to designate what they were was to alter the prefixes. Columbia didn't use prefixes, it just changed the series, and it really it changed and made the whole ball game a good bit harder. Victor, I should add here, since you asked, is the subject of a work by a very ambitious fellow named Ted Fagan of New York City and Palo Alto, California, who is compiling an encyclopedia of Victor records in which he will attempt to document every master produced by that company in both the continents of this hemisphere from 1901 to 1950, including 45 LP reissues, unissued material, trial material, and everything. It is a monumental work, and one of the reasons I'm so very far ahead with Victor is because of Ted's generosity in sharing his work with me. If that's all, I'll turn the podium back. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you, Jerry.
Joe Parker, National Library. I've mentioned this to the speaker already, so this is more for the audience. The Harold Smith collection includes a large amount of documentation on ethnic recordings. including perhaps some manuscript items that may not even be at Victor themselves, since they are manuscripts, such as travel logs of the ethnic salesmen and that kind of thing. Much of that is on exhibit out in the hall, by the way, if you want to get a taste of it. So this is a resource which we will try to help make available to other people doing that kind of work to our capacity to do so.
Jerry, what part of the hall is that in? Because I didn't see it coming in.
It's just going down the hall out of this area, continuing towards the other end of the library.
Oh, okay, past the main entrance?
Yes, yeah, fairly easy to spot because the dog is visible as you're walking down the aisle.
Thank you.